Hello and welcome to We Make Success Happen. Today,
this is the We Make Success Happen podcast.
I've always been intrigued by what makes people successful,
what success means to them,
and how we can apply their techniques to make our lives more successful.
This is the We Make Success Happen podcast with Matt Callanan.
Today, with amazing human, Martin Graham.
Hello.
Hello. So you're a senior lecturer in psychology.
I am indeed, yes. That's right, at University of South Wales.
And dating is your kind of main area, would you say?
My main research area, yes. So online dating, romantic relationships, my main research area.
Why online dating then?
Oh, question, but I think I've always been interested in things online and it just developed into looking at online relationships. That's how that's happened.
Because I guess it's a large percentage of particularly young people now that start relationships online.
Far more relationships start online than any other way. No, a paper out this year has shown us that maybe over twice as many relationships start online than any other way.
What do you think is a way to successfully start a relationship online? Is there a kind of, has anyone reached a formula or is there?
Well, maybe not a formula as such, but there are things you can and maybe shouldn't do, such as use the correct website, which kind of caters for you. Use a website which caters for, you know, your kind of interests. So you meet somebody with shared interests, advertise yourself carefully online, and make proper decisions and decide on people who you think you can have a good time with and don't rely on any kind of shopping list.
Why, do you think people have shopping lists then?
People do have shopping lists. People often discard people who might be perfectly suitable for them just by discarding, you know, characteristics which they think are undesirable, whereas maybe they wouldn't have a good time with that person anyway.
So I didn't really date online. That was before my time. But it comes across to me that seems very visual because you're going sometimes just on a photo. Is that the case?
It is the case. And that's maybe one of the downsides is that we form impressions based on kind of two-dimensional images rather than the kind of three-dimensional all round image of the actual person. But if you can get past that, then online dating is the way in which people kind of date these days.
So what do you think people should be doing then to maybe get noticed or get picked by the right person?
Well, I think you are you and you've got to advertise yourself as you. You can present your, you know, image of your face or your body or of your interests, but be honest and don't, as some people have done, put pictures up which, you know, years out of date.
So that kind of happens?
That happens indeed. Yeah, that does happen. And that's not a good way because you're only going to meet someone in the end that you might not look like you used to look.
So what about the people that might just say online dating isn't really for me? Look like the downfalls for people getting involved in that.
Oh, if it's not for you, if it's not for you. But like I said, far more relationships start online now than any other way. And there's also evidence as well that relationships which start online tend to be more sustainable than those which start face to face.
Oh, really? Why is that then, do you think?
I think the reason why is because at that kind of early stage, you're filtering out the people who you might not like. You get that chance to chat with people before you actually meet them. So when you meet the kind of right person, they might be more suitable for you than people you might have met in kind of real life, as it were.
So it's like it takes out the sort of randomness of just meeting someone in a bar or cafe or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. And online dating is convenience. It means you can meet a potentially large number of people, which you don't necessarily meet in a cafe or a bar.
So there's quite a few like different dating niches almost. They're like strangest ones that you've come across. There's obviously like ones for like doctors or nurses. What other ones are that are out there?
There are niche sites. There's one called Bristler, in which you, if you like people with beards. There's one, Uniform Dating, if you like uniforms. There's Tinder for threesomes. There's all sorts. But they cater for niche sort of interests. You're more likely, we know from the history of the study of romantic attraction, that you're more likely to be attracted to people who are similar to yourself.
What are some of your findings from this online dating world?
Yeah, okay. In terms of the way in which people advertise themselves and the way in which people make decisions, we found, and this kind of supports what's gone before, really, that females make far more rational decisions in terms of choosing more attractive people and choosing fewer people less attractive. For males, they seem to choose anybody. It's a numbers game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, indeed.
So what, they're just selecting just
as many as
women as possible?
Precisely, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. In the hope that they'll get chosen? Or is that down to a male psychology thing?
Pretty much, I think. Yeah, that's the kind of strategy. Females make more rational decisions. If you think that's more rational, to choose more attractive people, males don't. Just choose at random, almost.
Do you think time is a factor? Is it, do people end up being selected more late at night, say, or potentially when people come back from the pub?
That's a very good question. Could indeed. Probably not advisable to do that when you come back from the pub, perhaps. I think you need to be in a kind of rational and sober state of mind, perhaps, to be selecting people.
What are some of the terms that you've come across? So there's things like fubbing, sexing. What was the other one? Dating in winter?
Cuffing.
Cuffing? Yeah, do you want to talk about some of those then?
Yeah, sure. Cuffing is supposed to be meeting somebody in the autumn who you're going to kind of settle for the winter, allegedly because you can stay in with somebody in a sort of long, cold winter nights and not have to make the effort of going out dating.
What, and then leave them in the spring and summer or something?
Well, quite possibly.
And what about fubbing?
Fubbing is ignoring somebody in favour of using your phone. So it's a portmanteau of the word phone and snubbing.
How do you think the phone has changed relationships then?
I think the fact that we have phones, we carry phones, makes everything a little bit more immediate. People can get onto their phones quite quickly, receive messages quite quickly, far more easily than they could years ago. Also, through social media, people are a lot more kind of out there than they were before. Our lives are not as private as they were before. It might affect the way in which people become jealous in terms of people looking people up on their phones and social media to see what their romantic partners might be up to.
So would you say it's been mostly positive then, having phone in relationships?
I think it's certainly made communication much easier, but it's also given rise to people being a little bit more suspicious. Apparently 10%, I think it is, of cases of romantic relationship cheating have come to light through evidence on a phone.
Oh, really? Why is dating interesting to people?
All research really should have a utility, and it might seem a little bit quirky, online dating as a research topic, but we know that people who are in good relationships do tend to be happier, they tend to be healthier, they tend to live longer. So if we can understand the way in which people get into good relationships, then that's got that kind of real economic and social utility.
What are the main areas that you've looked at, and how have you got those kind of conclusions?
Okay, well, one of our recent research projects has been looking at the way in which people use Tinder, which are described in terms of the ways in which people make decisions about who they choose as a romantic partner. We've also done a little bit of research into what's called online infidelity, which tended to show that people become just as jealous in online relationships as face-to-face relationships, which struck us as being a little bit bizarre, because online there's no threat of sexual infidelity. People still become just as jealous of people chatting with somebody else online, sharing secrets and so on. And we've done a little bit of research as well into what we call validation in social media, so the way in which people use social media in order to get reinforcement and get that kind of validation, get likes and get liked and noticed on social media. We transfer that a little bit starting to look at that in terms of how that affects relationships and the ways in which you can positively affirm your relationship, show your love. Rather than bringing a bunch of flowers, you post something nice online. So, you know, how that might enable people to sustain relationships in a better way.
Is that just as effective then as buying, to say, if I posted a lovely message about my wife online on Facebook, is that just as effective as buying some flowers then?
I don't know if it's as effective. I don't know. It depends how much you like flowers and how much you like being
Could be a bit
online.
Cheaper though, couldn't it?
Could be. Absolutely be cheaper. But it certainly means that you can do that wherever you want. If you had to take your wife a bunch of flowers, you'd have to go buy them, go home. She wouldn't get them until later on. You can interact on social media pretty immediately. It's far more convenient to do that way. Whether it's as effective or as high a token of romantic appreciation as flowers is maybe another matter.
So as a psychologist then, how do you delve into those areas and get good results? Do you have a certain number of people that you have to go out with, go to, and get that kind of research?
Yeah, we our Tinder research, for example, has just been a reconstruction of that kind of environment and just getting people in to use it as if they were dating. So they're not actually dating, but they're using that environment as if they were looking for a romantic partner. So we're monitoring their behavior, albeit in a kind of artificial way, but we're asking them to put themselves in that position of thinking that they're looking for a partner and seeing how they respond.
So you speak all around the world, all about dating.
I have done in, I don't know, all around the world, but I have done in Australia, New Zealand and Canada and the States, yes.
That's quite a lot of the world, really. Well, yeah. So where do the sort of countries are most receptive to, which countries are most receptive to being open to hearing about online dating and how social media can change relationships?
I think, at least in these, what we might call westernized countries, everyone's equally interested in being in a good relationship. People are looking for guidance on that. So if our research can help people to get into a good relationship, then hopefully we've done something useful.
So is that the kind of the main point of your research then, is to actually help people into better relationships?
Well, yes, yeah, I think so. If we can do that, if it's got impact in terms of helping people get into good, sustainable relationships, then we've had an effect.
So if you're in a good relationship, what should people not be doing with their phone to to stay in that kind of relationship?
I don't think it's a case of what you shouldn't be doing with your phone, unless you're contacting anybody else outside of your relationship. But people in good, sustainable relationships, surely by the time you've been in a relationship for a couple of years, you kind of trust your partner and what they're doing with their phone. So it's maybe in the early stages, perhaps, that people are a little bit suspicious and people want to look at each other's phones. But there is some sort of anecdotal evidence that one of the kind of deal breakers in a relationship is to not give your significant other your passcode so they can look at your phone. Because our phones are our sort of personal property, they contain our bookmarks, our photos, our address book and contacts, our calendar, everything is in our phones. That's your kind of life, and each one is different, isn't it?
Isn't there a term called micro-cheating or something that's to do with phones?
Yes, there is. Yeah, micro-cheating is a phrase coined by an Australian psychologist called Margie Schilling. It's not necessarily to do with phones, but it's to do with behaviour which shows an interest in somebody else, which is not sanctioned by your romantic partner. Why that's become more relevant through this use of social media and phones is that there's far more facility then to micro-cheat to, for example, like somebody else's posts or stay in touch with an ex or something like this than perhaps there is in kind of real life.
So when does it cross over the boundary then into micro-cheating?
I think micro-cheating is really when you are doing something intentionally to show an interest or romantic interest in somebody outside of your relationship, which is not sanctioned by your current partner.
So as a kind of psychologist, what do you think makes the brain tick, or why do you think humans behave the way that they do?
That's a very, very broad question. What makes people behave the way they do? There are, I guess, several broad drivers, I think, aren't there? There's the way in which we act according to our evolutionary past. We act in ways which are adaptive. So we act in ways which, likely to lead to our greatest survival or the survival of our offspring. So that's one of the kind of main drivers which drives our behavior generally.
And what brought your interest into psychology then?
Well, it's a different kind of story, I think. I got interested in psychology when I was in the sixth form in school. I went to the local library and looked at what was labelled the psychology section, which had lots of books on assessing handwriting and extrasensory perception, all this kind of thing. I borrowed the book on handwriting and read a few chapters of that, and everyone in school seemed very interested in having their handwriting analysed. There's absolutely no validity in
Handwriting analysis. None at all?
No.
Really?
Very little, if any. But everyone was very intrigued by my...
Yeah.
That's just a strange story. I don't think that... Yes.
So from that book then, where did you move on to then? And you think, okay, that's an area that I'm going to take my life in then?
I think I got a few more sensible books on psychology, which I read and interested me, and was fortunate enough to go to university to study that as a undergraduate, and my interest in that has been sustained ever since then.
And what was your PhD in then?
It was in something slightly different. It was in use of what's called hypertext, which we probably don't use the term anymore, that little bit of blue in text on web pages, which will hyperlink you somewhere else, like you get lots of in Wikipedia, for example. So it was about the use of that for learning, and if that helped people learn more. So that's more sort of basic internet stuff.
Yeah. And how did you move from that then into dating?
I've always been interested, had an interest anyway in dating, even though that wasn't my PhD subject. So I thought, I don't know, I can combine my interest in that perhaps with my interest in the internet and in psychology of the internet. That's how I became interested in that. I had a student a couple of years back who had done a little bit of work as well on, you know, internet psychology and romantic relationships, and it grew from there.
What do you think is the psychology of internet? Why do you think certain people behave the way that they do?
The internet is really pervasive in our lives now. I don't know if you can imagine a world without the internet. One of the big ways is what we call online disinhibition. So the way in which we behave, we're a lot less inhibited about what we do in terms of, you know, what we look at on the internet, what we say to people online. So it does change our behavior in some ways, in as much as we're less inhibited about what we do, what we say.
Why do you think that happens then?
Probably because there's a kind of almost like a feeling of a little bit of a barrier between us and the person to whom we're talking, or there's a barrier between us and what we're actually looking at. People can't see us looking at what we're looking at. With that kind of barrier, it's a bit like being able to taunt a vicious dog as long as it's behind a fence. You're quite happy to stand there if the fence is there. If the fence goes, then we'd probably run away, wouldn't we?
So people can't really, they don't correlate it as real life then. They see it as something completely separate.
That's the kind of theory, yes, but the research tends to show that people will disclose more, far less inhibited about what they do when there's that kind of false barrier between them and what they're looking at and who they're talking to.
Why do you think they are less inhibited then? What does that come down to?
I think they're less inhibited because they think they can't be seen, or the person who they're talking to is not standing next to them.
But then I think the worrying part of that is that mm-hmm. everything can be recorded or is digital, and there's a longer history then, I guess, isn't there? If
this is true, but I think probably many people are not aware of that. You leave a kind of digital footprint. I wonder if you ask people how many people were aware of that, they probably wouldn't be.
So where do you think the world of online dating is going to go?
That's a fascinating question. The one kind of area is probably into artificial intelligence kind of thing. So you get, I know that Match.com, for example, have a little sort of assistant which kind of helps people as well, or in their dating pursuits. Or you have an ability to perhaps be able to smell what somebody's like on online, or seeing three-dimensional images, that kind of thing. I think in order to sustain it and to, you know, get people to keep on using it, those advances have to come about.
So it potentially could be more human features.
That's right, because as we discussed earlier, all in our sort of two-dimensional profile pictures, and you're basing your choices on that. If you get the opportunity to see somebody and how they behave, how they might smell, what they sound like, then you can base your judgment on that. Yeah.
So one of the things I wanted to talk to you, and I think I met you here at Good Gym.
Right.
So do you want to tell us, because this happens all around the UK, and it might be starting outside of UK, but do you want to tell us a little bit about Good Gym and what it does?
Yeah, sure. So Good Gym is an organisation which started in London about 10 years ago. There are Good Gym branches, if you like, in various cities now in the UK. And the idea behind it is it's a running group who meet on a Tuesday, in Cardiff at least, 6:15. What we do, we run so far, we run to what's a little task, whether it be gardening or painting, basically trying to do some good in the community. And we do that for half an hour, maybe about 20, 30 people perhaps, and then run back. But what we're trying to do is combine doing good with running. So that's the kind of rationale behind it.
And you wear, so most Good Gym runners, they wear red tops.
That's right.
And you wear a black top, don't you? Do you want to do it? Why are you wearing a black top?
Okay, so every time you do a good deed, you get a good deed point, as it were. When you reach 50 good deeds, you get a black top. When you reach 100 good deeds, you get another red top with 100 on the back. So as you progress, as you do more and more good deeds, I've been doing it now for 2 years, you get different shirts according to how many tasks you've done, how many good deeds you've done.
How many are you up to now then?
I'm up to 109, I think.
So you've reached peak tops in terms of, you've got the wings or whatever.
I've got the wings now, yeah. But one of the guys has got to 200 as well, so.
Wow, that's good.
So.
And what do you think is the benefit to both yourself and to the community through getting involved with something like Good Gym?
I think it benefits the community because we go and help out. We go and, you know, paint, garden and things like that. When we do tasks which shared between sort of 25, 30 people, it would take two or three people a lot longer to do. So we can get a lot done in the time we have. Also, it does us a lot of good because it gets people out running. We do a few sort of little exercises along the way. And all in all, it's a good bunch of people who are very nice, very sociable. We've become good friends and we've been on other kind of excursions and things together. It's all good and everyone's a winner.
What do you think is the kindest thing that either you've done yourself or you've seen someone else do for someone?
One of the things the group runs on a Tuesday, we do little tasks for people who are of a certain age. I think it's over 60, going to somebody's house and doing some gardening for somebody who can't manage their garden. So I've liked doing that and going along and just straightening up somebody's garden, somebody who maybe mow the lawn but can't bend down into the borders and things, and doing that and seeing the appreciation on people's faces. And that's really nice to see.
Yeah, because didn't Good Gym start as a way to initially just be running straight to elderly people?
That's the third way in which you can get involved. Good Gym is what we call coach runs. You get assigned to an elderly person, you run to them once a week, stay with them for half an hour, have a cup of coffee or something, and then run back. And it's a way of the person who's running is keeping fit by running, the person to whom you're running, you're always getting company for that amount of time. And as you can imagine, there must be lots of elderly people in the community who are not seeing people. So it really does, I think, have a big effect on trying to tackle a little bit of loneliness.
Why do you think something like Good Gym is important?
I think it's important firstly, for the people involved in it. I think it's important sort of for the exercise they do. I think it's important socially. I think it's also important that we're aware of, you know, things going on around in the community, helping out as much as we possibly can and having an effect in that way.
What does success mean to you, Martin?
In which particular way do you think?
To you personally.
What, anything or?
Yeah.
I have to say my children are my biggest success in my life and what they do. Yeah, out and away in front of anything else. Apart from that, I suppose work and being able to, if I've researched something, to be able to say that has had an impact on people's lives. I don't know, I guess generally getting on with people and being happy.
I like it. So do you think relationships will always stay the same? Because you talked about artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there could be a time when people think they're dating a real person and it's actually a computer or a robot?
Yeah, there's a test to test for that. I think it's the Turing test, the sort of questions you ask about how to tell if somebody's a robot or not through certain questions. But there is talk, isn't there, of robots kind of replacing people in relationships, whether that is ever going to come about and how far down the line that is. I don't really know. I don't know what I think about that personally.
Artificial intelligence has to learn about emotions, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Because that must be one of the hardest things to replicate, is individual emotions and individual reactions to certain things that happen in relationships.
Yes, exactly. So whether we're able to do that and whether we're able to do that in a convincing enough way to keep people happy with robots is another matter. But I'm sure they must have uses, even if we can't simulate emotion for company for people who are on their own, perhaps. That might be one thing they would be very useful for.
Do you want to tell us about the band you're in as well?
Okay, yes. So I'm the lead singer and sometime drummer with a band called Zimbando. We play maybe a couple of times a year. It's formed from myself and a couple of guys in work. The name comes from an American psychologist called Philip Zimbardo. We ran a competition with our students a couple of years ago who came up with the craziest name for a band, and Zimbando won the competition. So we've got a van now for our next gig, which we're naming Zimbando.
So, yeah. I like it. Yeah. So where can people find out about you, Martin, and some of the work that you've done and look at some of the talks that you've given as well?
I guess wait to find out about me and troll me if you want on martingraff.com. So my Twitter address and everything else is on there. So if you really want to come and look me up, then visit martingraff.com.
What would you recommend to listeners to have a successful online? They might be newly single or want to get into the dating world. How can they have a successful online kind of dating thing?
By the way, one of the most popular times for online dating is between New Year and Valentine's Day.
Oh, really?
That's the peak time for online dating. So if you want to be successful, I think you need to be realistic, be honest about what you're saying about yourself, and recognize that probably people, will maybe how can I say this, misrepresent the way in which they portray themselves, but try to imagine the people you like, you're more likely to be happy with. Try to imagine the type of people you'd have a good time with. It's not all about meeting somebody you think you're going to marry. It's about meeting somebody you think you're going to have a good time with. Relationships develop from there. You might meet several people with whom you might go on a couple of good dates with, but they don't suit you for a long-term relationship. But be yourself, be honest. I think that's the biggest advice, really. Otherwise, you might get yourself into a situation where if you're not being honest, then people are going to find out about you eventually.
So if it's so visually driven, have you looked into anything to do with what makes a more successful photo, or what should people be putting in photos?
Photos tend to matter, and not being sexist, more for females than for males. Males can compensate in some ways, and I guess there are women who will disagree with me, but can compensate in many ways by displaying aspects of their wealth, their power, their intelligence, and so on. So that's the kind of way it works in evolutionary psychology. So males can compensate for physical sort of shortcomings in some ways by sort of other characteristics. That happens less with females.
What do you mean by that? As in, they might be sitting on a fancy car or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's the way around it works in what we call evolutionary psychology. That's the way we've been evolved to look at romantic attractiveness in the opposite sex, at least.
What does that mean exactly, evolutionary psychology?
Okay, how long we got? Okay, so in our evolutionary past then, if you can imagine when you got a male and female together, it's biologically only possible for a female to become pregnant, not for a male. While a female is pregnant and cannot gather food, relies very much on a male to provide for her. Therefore, that male has to be capable, intelligent, strong, and so on. Those are the characteristics which, if females in our evolutionary past didn't choose, then they would die out. So the types of females who've evolved and survived are those who chose males who had those other characteristics. For a male, we're looking for a female who's attractive and who's able to have children, because that means that we would be successful in terms of continuing our genetic line.
How is that displayed in the modern dating world?
It's displayed in the modern dating world by males advertising their wealth, their intelligence, their power, as well as their good looks, and females displaying their good looks.
How can people spot when you think they're embellishing the truth too far? Or do you think as humans we can spot when people are lying or just not being truthful?
So there's two different questions. I guess we learn ways of spotting how people are lying if we know people a little bit better, and we can maybe detect that. That's not really my kind of area. In terms of the ways in which people misrepresent themselves online, there's been some research by a psychologist called Monica Whitty, and apparently females will misrepresent their photographs a lot more than males, which kind of bears out what I just said in terms of how they look is far more important to them than the ways in which males look. And the ways in which males misrepresent themselves is more in terms of their power and their wealth and their socioeconomic status. Now, females don't tend to misrepresent those kind of characteristics as much.
So are you saying as a female, they might choose like a younger picture or something like that?
That's the way probably in which you'd misrepresent. You wouldn't put a picture up of someone else, obviously, because at the end of the day, you're going to meet somebody. So therefore, we can probably rely on the fact that I suppose people's pictures are probably the best they're going to look. You wouldn't want to put pictures up of you a couple of years back, because that's not how you look now.
And how do males misrepresent themselves then?
Males misrepresent themselves more in terms of their socioeconomic status, which is an indication of their wealth and their intelligence. They also misrepresent themselves more in terms of their relationship status. So in situations where they're trying to pursue another relationship online, they're more likely to do that than females.
And how does that work exactly? Is that through photos, or do they lie about their salary in text form?
Yeah. You can say that I'm an airline pilot, or I'm a this, or I'm a doctor, or I'm a lawyer, but you're actually not.
So have you like come across any of those people that completely embellished their status and what they earned?
I've not met anyone like that. I've not interviewed anyone like that, but I've looked at the data on the people who do that.
So it is quite common then?
I don't know how common it is, but people actually do it.
Yeah. And what about catfishing? Have you looked into that, or is that... something you've come across?
Yes, kind of hearing about it. And that's a big problem, really, in terms of people trying to, what we call dating scams, people sort of trying to scam other people out of money. Rather frightening, anecdotally, the ways in which, you know, people have been scammed and conned, not necessarily to do with their intelligence. Various people have been conned and scammed. It is a bit of a problem, and there are guidelines to look out for in terms of not sending people money before you've actually seen them, or not send the money anyway, certainly not before you've seen them.
Do you actually lecture to students then, or are you more in the research area?
I do a bit of each. So I do some lecturing and I do some research. My time is split between those two things, really. So part of what I teach is cyber psychology, is about sort of the ways in which people behave, you know, on social media. Is about the ways in which people behave when they're in romantic relationships, and how they behave online when they're in romantic relationships, how they make decisions about people through online dating. And those are three of the main areas which I teach also.
And do you think some of your students are having more successful relationships as a result of your lectures?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I don't think that's the goal of teaching this. I think it's more to do with you know, teaching them that, getting them interested, and getting them to maybe do some kinds of assessment on those topics rather than coach them in relationships.
I'm sure it was in your talk that isn't there some evidence that proves that if there's a photo of a male carrying an instrument or look like this, or carrying like a guitar case, that they're perceived as more attractive?
That's right. So one of the characteristics which makes males more attractive, and the research tends to bear this out, is if males are creative. So in one little study, they had males walking around a town carrying a guitar case and then asking females for their phone numbers. And what the researchers found was that the guys who were carrying guitar cases, at least, were more successful than guys who just walked around with nothing.
Why do you think that is then?
And the reason they speculate that's the case is because if you're carrying a guitar case, it looks like you're more creative because you can play the guitar. If you're more creative, then you're probably more intelligent, or at least creatively intelligent. If you're creatively intelligent, then that's one of the assets you have to advertise yourself as a male. Makes you more attractive because you're going to give offspring those intelligence genes.
Oh, wow. Is that an actual kind of fact then? If you are creative, you're potentially more attractive or more intelligent?
Both. If you're more intelligent and you're more creative, then you're more attractive, surely. But for a variety of reasons. And you might be more, for example, you might be more interested, mightn't you, if you're creative. If you can play the guitar, you're certainly more interesting than if you don't play the guitar. I don't play the guitar, but if you do interesting things, perhaps, that makes you more interesting, therefore more attractive. But there's evidence as well that males who are more creative tend to have more sex with their partners than males who are less creative, and so on and so forth. So it's one of your assets, I guess.
It's looking good for everyone in the creative industries.
There you go.
It?
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, if a male is single and they got someone to take a photo of them potentially holding a guitar,
yeah,
even if they didn't play, they might actually get more kind of results, do you think?
They may do. I mean, from the evidence from the study I've just outlined, yeah, that would seem to be the case if you were carrying a guitar. Like I said, the only thing is that if you can't play it, then, you know, somewhere down the line, yeah, Someone's going to find you out.
And what does that work in reverse for a woman then?
Not the same for women. So being creative as a woman is not as important as it is for males.
Oh,
so
really?
There's lots of creative things you can do, such as, like I said, playing the guitar, or saying you're playing a band, or that kind of thing, or painting, or writing a poem. So those kinds of things are far more important in the kind of male repertoire of what you advertise yourself as than it is for females.
So what tops in males then, what tops finance in terms of what attributes are more attractive? Does creativity top finance in terms of what someone earns?
Okay, that's a complex question because so finance is important. Again, going back to a kind of evolutionary angle, if you're financially stable or you're quite wealthy, for a female that looks like you are very able to support a family and look after offspring, give them the best kind of life you possibly can. But it's only important for that.
Yeah.
So, but being creative has a different effect, because if you're creative, then you're passing on good creative genes to the next generation. So basically we're saying that someone who's creative is good to have sex with. Someone who's wealthy is good for being able to provide for your family.
So is there a certain number of attributes that people look for? Is it like three and they go, oh, that's more my kind of person?
Not really. I think those kind of things might help, but ultimately you've got to be attracted to somebody, you've got to be able to live with them and like them and get on with them. Whether those things override being intelligent or being wealthy, that might be the case.
Yeah. So is it more common that people are attracted to someone visually first?
I think we are, yes. At least for males, again, the evidence seems to suggest that males are more likely to fall in love at first sight than females, even though you might think females are more romantic. Females are far more discerning about who they want than are males. So, you know, males see attractive females, fall in love. That's the kind of first thing you might be looking for. It's not the only thing that females are looking for.
Do you think males fall in love slower than women, or do you think women fall in love quicker with men or their partners? Is there anything in the genetics or their genes?
The research seems to suggest that males fall in love a lot quicker because they fall in love with what somebody looks like. For females, there's a lot more to take into account.
So do you think people fall in love online before they've even met them physically or in real life?
Some people have reported saying that. So going back to the dating scam angle, you know, good professional scammers are almost able to make their kind of online partner, who they've not met, think that they fall in love with them, even though they're not met. So it's a case of telling somebody that you like them, how good they look, I'm looking forward to seeing you. You can imagine someone at the other end who's not been in a relationship for quite some time, perhaps being sucked in by that. That's the kind of way it works.
But is there something you're looking at in the dating field that you're currently researching?
We're still looking at the data on the Tinder study and looking now at the kind of response times and seeing who make faster response times.
Oh, really? As in like the male or female who
responds
quicker? That's
right, yes, yeah, and what they respond to. And bizarrely, it seems to show at the moment that females are making faster responses and more rational ones. Males are making slightly slower responses and making rational.
Do you think that's just because males are slower and less rational anyway?
Yeah, it might be that females are just filtering out, not making as many choices, but they're doing that a lot quicker.
Yeah. So is there something in relation to dating that you really want to discover that you potentially haven't looked at yet?
Yes, one of the ideas we got is to look at really how long it takes somebody to stop online dating and when they get no success.
Hey, really?
I think that's quite important because if you get no success, then, you know, in a kind of behaviorist sense, when you get no response to anything, then your behavior tends to what we call extinguish. It tends to stop. So unless you're getting some kind of success through online dating, people are gonna pack that in. So we want to know really what are the factors which influence somebody's thought about stopping dating and calling it a day.
So do you think people are having more success in dating now because the internet and mobile phones are about compared to the old school, which might be a bit more kind of random?
I think no question, yes. Yeah. I think the amount of people who meet online has gone up, and the amount of people who met in other forms, through work, through, you know, school, college, through friends, has gone down. And that's because of the convenience of phones. Almost means that you can shop for a date pretty quickly. You don't have to think, oh, I think I'll go out tonight and see if I can find somebody. You can theoretically find someone on your phone fairly rapidly.
I like it. So final question then, Martin. So imagine all your friends and family are sat down by a beach looking out to the sea, nice blue sky, mm-hmm. The sun's out, and you've hired a little plane which carries one of those banners behind it with some words on, and these are your final words of wisdom.
What?
What would it say on there?
To my friends and family?
Yeah.
I think it would just say, be happy. Be happy, be kind.
I like it. Martin Graff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Subscribe, rate, and review the We Make Success Happen podcast.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, I would really appreciate you leaving us a great review up on iTunes or your Apple Podcast app. It means a lot. Thank you very much. I've been Matt Callanan, and I'll see you on the next episode.
This is the We Make Success Happen podcast with Matt Callanan.